over there way too quick. Well, I'm speedy and I'm an alcoholic. Sam was telling me it was going to take a little, wasn't going to take too long to get started, but I didn't think it was going to be this quick. So I have to start out and saying I really like the reading that you guys used to open this meeting, because it talks about hope, you know, desperately in need. And the book closes the same way when it talks about when this chip of a book is launched on the world tide of alcoholism. Our hope is that every alcoholic who reads these pages will take up on this idea, whatever the words exactly are, and come into this program. And when I got here, I was desperately in need, I can tell you that. And I didn't know it, but a lot of other people did, thank God. And I'll get to that very shortly. I want to thank Sam for asking me to come down here tonight. I haven't been down this way for a long time. Well, I was at one speaker's meeting here recently, and other than that, I haven't been to a meeting in Madison for years and years. I used to go to quite a few of them, and that's been a long time ago. But whenever I come down here, and especially I live out in Amosville, Virginia, fairly close to the Blue Ridge, so I'm just coming right down the mountain range to get here. And to think how fortunate and blessed to be able to live in this part of the world, you know, and be able to see it, you know. For many years I was here and I didn't see anything, you know, but the inside of a bar room or a whiskey glass or whatever it happened to be, and the existence just wasn't very good. But as a result of Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can stand here tonight and tell you that I'm truly grateful to be here, you know. And if I can find a little something to be grateful for today, I don't have to pick up a drink, you know, just a little something. And if I don't pick up a drink today, I've got a lot to be grateful for, and so does everybody around me. And that's absolutely amazing. Just before I got ready to come down here, a friend of mine called me from my home group, and we were talking for a good while, and he'd been sober for a long time. And he used to share all the time in the meetings out there that when he introduced himself, he said, "I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic, and everybody else is suspect." You know, trying not to judge other people whether they're alcoholic or not. And I said, and he was talking about a cousin of his that he said, "I know he's alcoholic too." I said, "Well, put me in that trio." He said, "Oh, there's no question about you." And we had a good time talking, and I told him I was coming up here, and he wished me the best of luck. But, you know, it's just those little casual chats. We started out talking about something else and ended up talking about recovery, and that's what happens when I'm around a bunch of alcoholics, especially sober ones. And if I wasn't, I'd be in bad shape today, you know. I think usually when I'm in an area where a lot of people don't know me, the first thing everybody wants to know is how I ended up with my nickname, Speedy. So I'm going to try to share that, because it's a part of my early drinking history. I grew up over in Winchester, and when I was a kid growing up, we lived in the city, and it wasn't until after I'd finished the fourth grade and we moved out into the country, and when we got out there, it was just the best thing I thought that ever happened to me. We lived way out in the country, and we didn't have a lot of neighbors, and anytime I wanted to, I could just take off and go to the fields or the woods. You know, I should have been born down here in these mountains, but I wasn't. And I always thought that I was really at peace with myself, you know. I didn't have any clue that I was starting to isolate at such a young age, and being by myself was easier than being with other people, because I got here, I found out I didn't have any social skills. I was bankrupt mentally, physically, spiritually, and everything else. And that whole deal and that move, when first moved out there, and I started out in the county schools instead of being in the city schools, and first thing you know, here was this city kid coming to the country school, and the guys would start picking on me and everything else. And I went and told the teacher one day that this guy was picking on me. I'd be walking down the hall with my books, and he'd walk up behind me and knock the books out of my hand. and I'd get upset, to say the least, but I wouldn't do anything about it. So I told the teacher that, and he said, well, next time he does that, he said, just turn around and hit him. So I'm not in a city school anymore. I'm a country boy. And the next time he knocked the books out of my hands, I just turned around and hit him right between the eyes right there and knocked him cold. And when he finally come to and got up, I made him pick up my books. We became really, really good friends. We did a lot of running around, a lot of drinking together. And part of that story, I might be jumping around a little bit, but part of that story really carries over to how I live my life. When I finally moved away from Winchester, and my son was 4 or 5 years old, and from the city to the country, and we were living out there, and there were not a lot of neighbors, and he was doing the same thing I did at that time. When he finally started school, he would ride the school bus to school every day, and there was a kid down the road was picking on him, and he told me, he said, well, the next time he picks on you on the school bus, I said, just take that lunchbox of yours and hit him upside the head with it. He had a metal lunchbox. And he hit that kid upside the head with that lunchbox, and it got ugly real quick. But that's the way I thought for a long time, you know, just, if things are not going my way, I'll just fix it so that it would, and I instilled that into him. And then years later, I'd wonder why he was the way he was, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, because he's quite a young man today, but he had to go through a lot of hell to get there just the way I did to get here. And the good news is, I was talking to Justine just before the meeting, and on Saturday night before Father's Day, I spent the Friday that evening with him in an AA meeting, and it's unbelievable to say the least. But we get back to this kid growing up out there in the country, and I would learn to smoke and drink there. You know. I ended up one time before I ever picked up a drink in jail. Me and a friend of mine down the road, I'd finally met this kid that lived down the road about a half mile or so from me, and we were in town one day, and we wanted to go to the movies, and we didn't have any money, so we figured we'd just take some. And that's what we did. And we went into a place of business that wasn't open, and we got the money, and we was on the way to the movies, and we got picked up by the law. And here we marched down through the middle of town, right down Main Street to the old city jail lockup there in Winchester, and we were sitting in this room, and it reminds me so much now of being NYPD type stuff. You're sitting in this little room with two detectives and a metal table, and they're questioning you about all this stuff that's going on. And this one detective looked at me and he said, would you like for us to call your dad? I said, Lord, no. I said, I don't want you to call him. I didn't have the nerve to tell those two detectives that he was going to be there shortly anyhow. He was their boss. That saved me from getting in a lot of trouble for a long time. And when things went bad and I'd get picked up by the law, and it happened all the time, I'd get taken home, sent home, or just told to behave myself and go on. And I don't know whether they didn't want to tell him or they just didn't want to get any more trouble. I'd already been in before the judge a couple times by then. And one judge told me, he said he thought he had a good place for me, and it was called Reform School. And I didn't know what that was, but it didn't sound very good. So I got out of having to do that, and then I found the booze, and it took all those fears away. It took that feeling of not having any social skills away and being able to talk to people. And I would go on with that and through my junior high school years and my high school years. And I finally got out of high school with pretty good grades. And I was a pretty good athlete in high school. In fact, I had a scholarship to a four-year university in track and field. And they trying to figure out how to get the financial end of it worked out. And my track coach was a graduate of this high school. He was also an Olympic and a pen relay champion, and he was everything you could ask for. And so he was doing a scholarship deal for me. And they, in order to make everything work out, they couldn't figure out how to get all the money together for the housing and everything. So here I am, not even in college yet, and he's got me living in a fraternity house that he belonged to before, when he graduated from college. It's part of the package, and it was an agriculture fraternity, for God's sakes. I didn't want anything to do with that. But even though I lived in the country, I didn't want to be a farmer at that time. I'd spent all my summers working on farms, and that was pretty hard stuff. But when it come time to go to, off to college, I just didn't show up. I'd already got to the point where I was drinking on a daily basis by then, and I get out of high school, and I get me a job working at an ice cream plant. And I'd do that all summer, and then all winter I'd just quit and go hunting and fishing and whatever I wanted to do. And I did that for a couple of years until I ended up getting married. And thank God for the booze. If it wouldn't have been for that, I wouldn't have been able to get married. I didn't have any social skills without it. And you get a drink in me, and I'm asking somebody to get married. And it was really crazy. And so we did. That was, it really started off as a disaster. I was on the way to the church for the wedding, and I'd forgotten the marriage certificate. So I had to go back and get it. And when I went back to the house to get the marriage certificate, I picked up a pint of liquor, and I drank that on the way back to the church. And everything really started off well. And I was, at that time, I'd gotten a job working in a factory, and I was making good money. This was back in 1963, and I was making almost $100 a week then, working in a factory 40 hours. And I thought that was really great, and I had my firstborn son came along, and they had changed jobs right before he was born, and I'd gone to work for Bob Bell for $57 a week and thought that was absolutely insane. My dad had suggested that I do that if I wanted any kind of a future. So one of the few times I ever took his advice, and I did that. So I went to work for Ma Bell, and I would end up down there in Norfolk, Virginia, in this school when my firstborn son was born. And I got a call that I needed to get home immediately. And I put my stuff all in the car to get ready to come home, and I'd lost my car keys, and I didn't have a spare. And I found them the next day. They were in a bar across the street from the hotel I was staying in, so I got home a day late. And 7 days later, on my 21st birthday, that son died. And until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and was able to get through these steps, I never shared that with another human being, ever. It was just gone. Went to the funeral, and it was nothing but just a few family members there, and went back to work, and didn't say anything to anybody at work about it, nothing. It was just like it never happened. It was just so deep down that I never talked about it, not even with my wife. It was absolutely insane, but that's just the way I was, and so introverted that it was just not funny. And working for those people at the phone factory, and first job I had there was I was climbing telephone poles, and no training. They just give you the tools to climb with, and there's older guys going to show you how to do it. And I'm out there one day, and one of the old guys, he'd been doing it like for 14 years. He said, "Put your hooks and belt on and climb up that pole." And he told me what he wanted me to do up there. And I got the stuff on, and I had a hell of a time getting up that pole, terrified. And I finally, working with one hand holding on to the pole with the other, which is no good in that business. And I got the work done finally, and getting down was worse than getting up. It really took a long time. And when we got in that evening to fill out our timesheet, this old guy was telling our boss, said, "Speedy over here is just like a squirrel on those telephone poles, boss. You ought to see how fast he got up and down." Well, I'm going to tell you, that pissed me off. You know, that was a negative connotation, and it stuck from that day to this. Everybody that I've been associated with, especially at work, all through my whole career, regardless of where I went or what I did, it was Speedy. And I made up my mind right then that if they were going to call me that, it was not going to be because of a negative connotation or a negative reason. And I worked like hell at every job I had and excelled at it, you know, to the point that I became the best there was at what I was doing at any particular job that I held. And I did that with my drinking, too. And it damn near killed me. But that's how that came about. I was... I had a job assignment one time that over a four-state area, I was the only person in all the management ranks in that area that was selected to take on that project. And when I got done, the president of AT&T was going to give me a personal accommodation in this great big crab, and meeting with the president of the Virginia company in Richmond and the whole nine yards. And I got this thing, and across the top of it where the name goes, it said Speedy Rogers. I said, "Damn, I'm really getting big shot in this outfit." But that's one of those little deals that, and all of it was driven by my ego and my fear. And of not being what you thought I was supposed to be. And that's the way I lived, that's the way I worked, and that's the way I drank until I just couldn't do it anymore. And I ended up working for that company until I retired. Shortly after I moved from Winchester area over to Amosville in Rappahannock County, and lost that umbrella of my dad's influence in the law enforcement community, things started going the opposite direction. And it didn't take long. I was coming home from Winchester one night down on 522 and lived in Flint Hill, and I got pulled over by a state trooper and in handcuffs and going to jail for driving drunk. And I asked him, I said, "Why in the world did you even bother me? I didn't think I was speeding." He said, "You was only doing about 30 and going down the highway on 522. And he said, "Besides that," he said, "somebody called me on the CB. That's when they all had CBs in their cars. And said, there was this little, he said, "I was over on the other side of the county." And this, he said, told him this little blue Jeep was going down 522 all over the road. Looked like it might be a drunk driver. And he said, "I just thought I'd come see if I could find you." He said, "It wasn't hard to find you." So I get out of jail the next day. We went back and got my old Jeep and went to Warrington and bought a CB radio. Now that's going to fix it. I'm here to tell you that doesn't work. Well, there'll be many more of those. And many different jails that I'd be locked up in for drunk driving and other stuff too. But and it became absolutely insane. There was a point where I had a lot of people working for me all over the company, and whenever there was a problem with somebody's drinking in my organization, and I didn't want to stir up a whole lot of stuff about getting rid of them, my keen alcoholic mind kicked in. I promoted them and moved them on down the road. One of them would turn out to be my sponsor. I after I got sober, I was found myself in Miami doing Hurricane Andrew, working on a hurricane restoration project. And right after the storm quit, and there was 4,000 people just in one group from all over the United States there from Ma Bell, and I ran into a lady down there, and she was the manager of all the logistics and supplies for that whole operation, and she was from Jacksonville. And I said, I know an old boy from Jacksonville. He used to be up in Virginia. She called his name. I said, no. She said, yeah, he's my boss. So she told him, and I called him, and he said, the next time you come up this way, I was in Miami, he said, stop by, and he said, we'll have a cup of coffee. He was one of the worst drunks that ever worked for me. It was pretty bad. And he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And shortly after that, my sponsor would be taking me down to Sessions by the Sea, and I'm standing there in front of the convention center. One day, and I looked up, and here was this little short dude, and a lot of you guys know him. He's been sober a long, long time. Standing in the doorway of the convention center. And I looked at him, I said, Gary, what in the hell are you doing here? And he said, well, I've been here for a long time. And he was one of those that was a bad drunk, so I thought, I never looked at me, I just looked at them. So I gave him a promotion and sent him on his way, and he got sober, and I did, and I had to finish the job first. And I did a pretty good job of finishing that up, and it went up to my last little deal with the driving drunk and the alcoholism and the family all in disarray and the jobs in trouble and the whole nine yards. And I'm in Rappahannock Jail, and the magistrate or the jailer or one of them called, wanted to know, they was going to let me out the next morning if I could get a ride home, and wanted to know if, wanted to call my wife, and I said, she's probably not going to come. The first time I ever called her, I was in Rappahannock Jail, and they told her the same stuff, we got your husband up here in jail, and she just said, keep him. And, but she agreed to come that time, and on the way home, it was really a quiet car ride. And I'm sitting over there, and she's driving, and she said, the only thing she asked me, she said, I want you to tell me one thing. I said, what's that? She said, do you have some kind of a death wish? And I said, no. She said, well, the way you're drinking, it appears that you must have some kind of a death wish. I said, why don't you just leave me to hell alone? I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And that was the end of that conversation until I got home. And I had no clue that that was the starting of me getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, years before, there was one of these books in my house, and it wasn't mine. And the bookmark was on the chapter to the wives. And I soon found out that she was willing to let me drink myself to death if that's what it was going to take to get me sober. She had give up the fight as far as trying to stop me from drinking. She had got to that point where we never try to arrange a man's affairs as to shield him from temptation. In fact, she said, have at it. I did. And so she understood what I was going through. She would talk later on one of these deals that I'd be sitting in my Lazy Boy recliner. And after work in the afternoon, and I'd have a pair of old boots there, and there was a pint of cheap vodka in each boot, and I'd be sitting there drinking, watching the news, waiting for dinner. And she would get my dinner out of the freezer, put it in the microwave, set it on the kitchen table and said, dinner's ready. And I'd just drink right on through it. And she'd put it back in the freezer. And the next day, out of the freezer, into the microwave, and onto the table. And after about a week of that, she'd have to throw it out and get another one started. It would be so terrible. But that's where I was getting. I was just drinking to oblivion every day and still trying to maintain the work and everything else. And I went to, had to go see the judge about that drunk driving, and there was a whole bunch of other arrest warrants associated with that, and things were not looking good. And the judge up in Rappahannock County had said something to me about, he told me straight out, there's no sense in sending you to ASAP. He said, it doesn't work. I'd been there three different times, one of them for 40 weeks straight. You know, the state mandate is like for 24 or something like that. And I just knew the only reason they wanted me to keep coming back was because I was paying them every Wednesday night when I went. And also, the very first Wednesday night I went to that one in Culpeper, that's where that one was. I'd been to different places. Went in there and the room was full of people and we was all waiting and the instructor was up front messing around with stuff and he pulls out this damn little thing with the little straw and he looked over at some guy and said, come on up here. Said that we're going to do this at random throughout this ASAP class just to make sure nobody's drinking. And this guy blew into that thing and they called the cops and off he went to jail. He was drunk in the ASAP meeting before it started. And I thought, I'll never do this again. So I never drank before the meeting. But as soon as it was over, I'd get in my old van and pull out that pint of cheap vodka and drink about half of it before I head back to Amosville. But I was smart enough to know not to drink before I went in there. And things was already going to hell in a handbasket anyhow. And so he suggested that maybe I might go to a little place down in Richmond, and the mailing address was 1600 Spring Street. Now, that was the mailing address of the old state penitentiary down on the river. And that didn't sound good. So I went and I got me a lawyer. I need some help with this. And I'm sitting up in his office on a Monday morning in Little Washington. And I got all this pile of papers there in front of me, and I told him, I said, you got to get me out of all this mess. And the first thing, there was a technicality in the way the arrest warrants were all written. And I pointed it out to him. I said, if we could take this to court and throw that up there, he's got to dismiss this. It's just wrong. And it was just a technicality. He looked at me and said, Speedy, he says, you don't really have a legal problem. He says, what you have is a drinking problem. And I said, oh, my God. And he said, if you're not willing to do something about your drinking problem, I'm not going to help you with your legal problem. And I thought the gates of hell slammed shut on me right there. I mean, just right there. So he suggested that I needed to go to some kind of a 28-day treatment program. Well, no. I said I might be able to do some outpatient, but I don't have time for that with my work and everything. He said, maybe you didn't hear me, but you need to do something about your drinking problem. He said, I know the company you work for has a fantastic EAP program. And he said, you need to go down there and talk to those people and see what kind of help you can get. So I'm sitting there. And on a Monday morning in his office at 10 o'clock in the morning, half in the bag, and I said, okay. Now, I didn't have a clue at that time, and it took me a long time to figure it out, that that's when the surrender started, when I said, okay. And I went and made me an appointment to go see that lady down in Washington, D.C. We had two medical departments, one in Richmond, down on Hungry Springs Road, great big complex with doctors and nurses, that whole nine yards. And I knew everybody down there from all my years being down there and for different things. And we were blessed that we got a physical once every year anyhow. And I'd go in there and the doctor would always ask me after the physical was done, how much are you drinking now? I said, oh, just a couple beers a day after work. He said, maybe you ought to cut back. No. So I made an appointment to go to the medical center in downtown Washington, D.C. Nobody there knew me. So it was a Monday morning at 10 o'clock again, and I'm down there on 8th Street in downtown Washington, up on the 7th floor, and I walked in there and introduced myself up to the desk where you walk in. They gave me a clipboard to fill all this stuff out and said, have a seat over there, and when the appointment time was ready, you can see the counselor. And I said, okay. And when I walked in there, they finally said, okay, you can go in now. She was on the phone. And she finished talking, and she got off the phone. She said, I've been talking to a treatment center for you. And I looked at her and I said, that's not why I came down here. She said, it doesn't matter why you came down here. She said, that's where you're going. Now, here I am at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning in downtown Washington, half in the bag again. And I often wondered how she knew. She had never seen me. She had never talked to me. She didn't know me from Adam. And she was on the telephone talking to a treatment center before she ever met me. And I finally asked her one time how she knew, and she said, it was pretty easy, Speedy. She said, I couldn't read anything on that paper you filled out that morning. She asked me while we were having that little interview she said, how'd you get down here in the morning? I said, I drove down in my company vehicle. I'm driving it back, too, and she never said a word. If she'd have challenged that, she'd have lost me right there, and she knew it. So she made arrangements for me to go to a treatment center, and I was going to. She told me, she said, if you want to, it was Karen Foundation had a chit-chat program in Winchester back at that time, and she said, you can go by there and introduce yourself to those people and get a date, the exact date you're supposed to check in. So I went by there one day and was talking to a lady in the offices, and she said, you need to stop drinking before you come in here. Cold turkey. I called that lady right back in Washington, and I said, my God, they told me just to stop cold turkey. She said, my God, don't do that. It'll kill you. She said, just drink as little as possible. I said, thank you. Little as possible was oblivion every day until I ended up there. And I would finally end up there, and I ended up in a nut house and before I got there. But, you know, that was another thing. Sitting in that office and she told me that you're going to a treatment center, and I just looked at her and said, okay. I come to understand that the surrender started a long time before I knew it was starting. There was something going on in my life that I didn't recognize. And thank God that it was, or I wouldn't be standing here today. You know, I ended up going into that treatment program, and I ended up in the nut house first, and that wasn't part of the plan. So it's really screwed up my whole travel plans. I was supposed to have been going to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, with a bunch of guys for golfing outing, and it had it perfectly figured out to the day that I could get out of treatment and go golfing the next day. And then they slapped me over there in the nut house before the treatment center, and it screwed up the plan. And these guys that I was going golfing with, we'd already paid all our money up front, a lot of money. And when I come back from the treatment center, none of them ever said a word to me about the golfing trip. They never offered to give my money back. They didn't do anything. And most of them I worked with, some of them worked for me. And I wasn't about to tell them where I'd been, so and they all knew. But I said something to my sponsor after we became connected about these guys took all my damn money and never said anything to me about it. He said, that's the best money you ever spent in your life and didn't use. He said, if you'd have gone on that golfing trip, he said, you wouldn't be here today. And I didn't know it, but he was right. But when I finally ended up in that treatment center, the very first night we was in there, they loaded us up in the old van and take us off to the AA meeting. And I'm standing outside of the church in my town I grew up in. And I'm terrified to go in. and terrified not to. I'm thinking, what if somebody rides by here and sees me that knows me? I've been gone for over 20 years. But just that fear. And I looked up, and here come Tom walking across the street with a big smile on his face and his hand stuck out. And he was one of those guys that had worked for me the years before. And I said, what in the hell are you doing here? And he said, I've been waiting for you for almost 9 years. And we got reconnected, and he became my sponsor, and he still is today. And what an absolute blessing it is. You know, I walked into that nut house on the 6th of January in 1992, and I came out of there and into that treatment center and into Alcoholics Anonymous, and haven't had to pick up a drink since. By the grace of God, you people on the program that's outlined in this book that's right here in front of me. So he became my sponsor, and we started this journey into these steps and into recovery and going through all these steps. And just, it's been an amazing journey. You know, when I first got sober, that son of mine that I was talking about that hit the kid down the road with a lunchbox, he'd already been in so much trouble. He had stolen a car one time, and I found out in Cooper Santee Lake and down south, and he was under a bridge in Miami and had to go get him. And another time he stole a bunch of money and guns and a car, and he was in San Diego. And another time he was in Reno, Nevada. He was locked up in jail that time, and he called for help. And I'm the one that said, leave him. And the wife said, no. She said, we're going to get him. And I was still drinking at the time we did that. He was probably 16. Well, he was a little older than that then. He was 16 when he stole the car the first time, I think. But we went to Reno to get him, and I called an attorney out in Rappahannock County that has reaches all over this country, and he had everything arranged. So we got to the airport there and checked into the hotel and called the attorney and made an appointment to see him the next day. He already knew we were coming in the whole nine yards. And so I'm going across the street to a supermarket to get some snacks and stuff to put in the room. And I walked into this big supermarket in Reno, Nevada, and one whole wall was liquor. And I went and got a cart and commenced to fill it up with booze and some chips and dips and all kinds of other stuff. And back across the road I went with all that stuff and over to the hotel. And my wife said, what in God's name are you going to do with all that booze? And I said, well, I might want a little taste while we're here. Ended up staying drunk the whole time. And he got through his court cases, and he had an old dune buggy. And so he was going to drive that back to Virginia. So I just told the wife, I said, you ride back with him, I'm going home. And I left and got on an airplane and came home. Now, I know I left Reno at 6 o'clock on a red-eye flight to San Francisco, and then from there back to Virginia nonstop. And I know I went through San Francisco and changed planes because I still had the tickets for it. But I can't remember any of that trip. It was all done in a blackout. When I left that hotel that morning to go to the airport for that 6 o'clock flight, I took as much of that booze with me as I could get and drank as much as I could before I got on the plane. And those things, there's just so much of that that goes on. And you know, I got to get sober here pretty quick. And but coming in here and started working on these steps and doing this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I would look at that first step, and Tom said, man, that's really simple. And I said, what is so simple about it? He said, well, you're an alcoholic, you can't drink. That's all you need to know, you know, and for a starter. And that was true. And I said, well, you know, had to take a look at that second step and coming to believe in something. And I recalled being in that treatment center, and we getting to use the phone in there was just like pulling hen teeth. It was almost impossible. And one night sitting in the little room there where we all hung out, the phone rang. It was a payphone on the wall. And it was my wife, and she called. And she didn't really want to talk a lot, but she just wanted to tell me that my son had called and asked how I was doing, and that just about floored me. I had no clue. He was living up here in the mountains in back of Sperryville in a one-room shack with no plumbing, no water, no anything in it, and he had an agriculture enterprise going on in Shenandoah National Park. They didn't like that, so they sent him to federal prison when they finally caught him. But he had called to see how I was doing. And that dawned on me, if there was any connection to a power greater than myself, it had to be that. And I really hung on to that. And so I talked to Tom about the second step. He said, it's an action step. I said, the book doesn't say it's an action step. He said, well, it is. He said, well, what do you got to do then? He said, go to a meeting every day. He said, you'll be in a whole room full of people that knows how to stay sober and you don't. He said, that's where you'll find a power greater than yourself. So I started coming to meetings every day. And I've been doing that practically ever since. And taking a look at this third step, and, you know, finally I couldn't understand the third step prayer. I couldn't remember it. I thought I had to remember it in order to be able to do the third step. And he says, really, don't worry about that stuff. He said, you just ask God every day to help you stay out of your own way and not take a drink. And I come to understand that's about the shortest version of the third step prayer I've ever heard. Just every day I ask God to help me not take a drink and stay out of my own way. And he handed me a 24-hour day book and suggested I use it. And from that day to this, the bookmark's been on the right page. And something works with that. And we took that third step prayer and he handed me a pencil. I said, well, what's this? He said, this is right at inventory. And I had a heck of a time getting through the inventory process, but I was able to get through it. And I called him and told him I'm done. And he said, yeah. I said, yeah, we can do a fist step right away. He said, well, just hang on to it for a little bit. And what he knew and I didn't know is I wasn't finished writing. And when I did get finished writing, I couldn't call him to save my soul. That's the biggest wall of fear I've ever gotten through in Alcoholics Anonymous. After I put every one of those little nasty details down there that our book talks about, every twist of character, we went to Sessions by the Sea, and I thought this is going to be the beautiful weekend to do a fifth step. Absolutely perfect. Nobody there. We're staying in an oceanfront hotel. We got a bunch of friends there staying with us, and I'll be able to do the fifth step. And I had it in a briefcase, and for the life of me, I couldn't pull it out and ask him to do a fifth step. Terrified. Went up to Browntown one day, and there was a lady up there. She'd been sober since Methuselah, Mary Squire. And I shared that I was really having a problem with getting rid of that fourth step and doing the fifth step. And she said, Speedy, she said, take that inventory home and put it under your mattress. I thought that was about the dumbest thing I've ever heard, but I did it. Then I couldn't sleep on it. The very next Friday evening after that, I'm in Winchester at my sponsor's home group, and it's a great big church hall, tremendous. And I walked in there early, and there was nobody in there except Mary Squire sitting way back in the corner. The first time and the only time I've ever seen her at that meeting. I walked over there. She said, you talked to Tom about doing that fifth step yet? I said, no. Well, you're going to have to do it pretty soon. But it wasn't just instantly, it seemed like a coincidence, you know what they are. Here comes Tom walking into the meeting hall. Mary said, there he is, go get him. He heard it. That Sunday morning found me sitting in his living room on a beautiful Sunday morning after we had gone to a meeting together and doing that fifth step. And when our book talks about we will be amazed before we are halfway through, I knew what that meant when I left his house that day and drove. He lived in Berryville, and I had that drive from Berryville back to Amosville on cloud nine. If there was anything about being on a pink cloud, that was it for this alcoholic. And I understood what it meant, and these promises were starting to come through, and I would get on with these steps and get on with my life. And it's got so much to talk about. You know, we were talking before the meeting about that son of mine and all that trouble he'd gotten into, and he'd been in different jails all over the country and everything, and he was in jail down in Southern Virginia below Richmond one time, and he was so ashamed that he told me he didn't want me to even think about coming and seeing him. And I respected his wish. And at that time, there was still a lot of negative stuff going on with me about the the stuff that he had done to me. I hadn't looked too much about what I'd done to him, all that stuff. And he had been to the point one time where he had everything in the world. Bill talks about it in his story, the goose hung high. Well, here was a kid that had it all at one time. He had the houses, the cars, the boats, a place on the beach, a place at the lake, and all of it went down the tubes after he started drinking and drugging again. And there'd been a good spell when he hadn't done that. And they were doing that spell that he had gotten married, and the twin grandchildren and the adopted granddaughter came along, and I spent a lot of time at their house, and times were really good until he went back down the tubes again, and I couldn't deal with that, and I talked to my sponsor about it a lot. And he told me one time, he said, Speedy, he said, what you got to do is you got to tell him you love him and you got to cut him loose. He's got to find his own way home here just the way you did. And I was able to do that. And when he was down there in that jail, and when he was getting ready to get out that time, he wrote me a letter and told me he was getting out of jail in a month or so. And he said, when I get out, I'm going to come back to Amesville and live with you. And I wrote him a letter back, and I said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but that won't work for me, and it won't work for you. That you're going to have to find your own way and do what you need to do to straighten your own life out. And he came back, and he found a place to live, and he had a great job, and he was making good money again, and the drugs came back in, and the booze came back in. And back to jail he went, this time for a long time, and he ended up down in Dillon. And he got there, and I would go down and visit with him once every month. He asked me to come this time. And the first time I was down there, he was telling me as soon as he got there that one of the first things they offered to him was an opportunity to join a AA or NA group. And he signed up, and they couldn't have both, but they could only have one. And at the time he signed up, they didn't have any openings in an AA group there. It was maxed out, so he joined the NA group, and he went to at least one meeting every week for the whole time he was in prison there. And he'd signed up, and he took all this other counseling and continuing education, and I could see things were different in his life. And I would go down and see him every month. And the first wife of his, that when I was 6.5 years sober, she had packed up and left him when the grandchildren were 6 months old and went back to where she had came from. And I carried a resentment about that for a long time. And I heard she was in a bad car wreck. And I called my sponsor. He was living in London. And told him about this car wreck. And I said, you know something? I said, God sure did miss a good chance to get rid of my number one resentment. Now, that's what I told my sponsor about this young lady when I was 6.5 years sober. And he busted out laughing. And he kept on laughing. And the next thing you know, it was a belly laugh. And the next thing you know, I'm laughing with him over the phone. And we got done. And I said, man, I'm sorry, but I said, I've been praying for her and praying for her and praying for her, and it just doesn't work. He said, Speedy, don't you think it's about damn time you started praying for yourself? And not only did he tell me that, he took me to the prayer in this book, in the fourth step, where we ask God to help us understand that, paraphrasing, that they, like ourselves, are spiritually sick too. Now, I was okay with that until I saw that two on there. Now, that was putting the ball back in my court. And I was able to deal with that and make the amends with that. And some years later, she ends up in my hometown again, living with my grandchildren. And I go into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous up with my sponsor, and she's there. And she's coming up on a year sober. And I'm speaking at her anniversary, volunteered to do it. So where in God's name is this coming from? She went back out and drank again. And I didn't speak at her anniversary after her first year this time, but she asked me if I would come to Winchester at a noon meeting and give her her 18-month ship. And I did that. And she started going down to that prison every week to see that son, too. And they reunited with the grandchildren and living back in Winchester. When he got out of jail this last time, he was down in Greenville. And he got out at 8:30 in the morning. She picked him up, and at noon that day they were in a meeting at the Quaker House in Winchester, and been going ever since. And this Father's Day, I got to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him, and been to quite a few with him. He called me. I'm going to wind this up here pretty quick. He called me here a couple Sundays ago. I was away someplace doing something, and he was over towards Amosville, had a little business to take care of over that way. And he said he was going to come by the house if I was there. And I said, well, you can go by any house. I said, you know where the house key is? And I knew he didn't. And he said, no, I don't have a clue. And I told him where the house key was. And when I got home that night, I didn't even run around the house to see if anything was missing. That relationship's been restored. There's a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You people have got my understanding. And that's just one of the things I can talk about tonight. You know, there's so much that's happened in my life as a result of this program, but it's all about gratitude for this alcoholic today. You know, when I first got sober, old Glenn Fraser up there at Little Washington, every Thursday night he would talk about finding something to be grateful for. And he said, gratitude. He said, you can't manufacture it; it has to come from the heart. And he said, you usually see it in a smile to start with, and That's he's been gone a long time, but I still carry that message with me everywhere I go because it's been so important in my recovery, and it's one of the things that makes me so grateful to be here tonight with you people, you know, that I can share a little bit about who I am and what I am today, and for that I am truly grateful, and I thank all of you for being here.
Thank you.